Okay, welcome back to the programme. Martin McHugh is going to be joining us shortly to reflect on the life and career of Micheál Omar-Hertig. If you have any memories you wish to share, 086 60 25,000. Okay, let's take a few comments though to lead up to that. A caller says, I've spent 25 years serving in the army. I think he's brought great shame and disgrace in our national force. I sincerely hope the army issue the punishment the courts should have by giving him a dishonourable discharge. Now, I wouldn't be sort of a massive fan of collective responsibility. It does seem to, this case does seem to be used as a stick to beat all of the army with. I'm not sure that's justified. I did know down the country, I think it was some pride event, maybe in Limerick, that asked members of the Defence Forces not to take part off the back of this. I don't see how that's helpful, to be honest with you, but maybe people out there have a different understanding of that. The parents of this person, of this big brave soldier, as is described, who beat that woman, must be so proud of him, says a listener. Fentanyl is the name of the drug, I think you referred, the zombie drug. Indeed it is. Thank you very much. And I just could not get the name of that drug out of my mouth. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Danny and Sandra of the Donegal Donkey Sanctuary are two of the nicest people you would ever meet. The work they do to look after the donkeys is exceptional. When you meet them, you can easily see how much they care about the donkeys. I would encourage Highland listeners to go. Call the guards if they have any information to catch the thugs and donate a little to the sanctuary, who get no funding, no state funding. Thank you, Danny and Sandra, and take care, says that texter. Could you ask, please, about codeine and how dangerous it is? Unfortunately, I got that a little late, but any listeners out there that have an insight into that, let us know. Greg, why is there such a surge of young people going missing? A few years ago, it was said that this was a Facebook thing done for a laugh, but it happens so often now and takes up so much resources. A fellow who was found this week after going missing for a second time was in a house cared for by HSC. It wasn't an ordinary home. I feel this should have been mentioned when the alert first went out. Love the show. Thanks for airing my view. There's, I said this on a number of occasions, that this month in particular, there was a 14, 15 or 16-year-old that went missing every single day. Thankfully, for the most part, they returned safely. In their entirety, they returned safely, as far as I could determine. And I pointed to the fact that this was just too familiar a trend, one every day, because I get the notifications from An Garda Síochána, and I put it out to see if anyone knew of any trends that were on TikTok, most likely now, or Snapchat. But I couldn't find any. Now, that is not to downplay, perhaps, maybe the stresses on young people. But it's just with the frequency and the age category, it seemed just to be too formulaic for me. And that's why I was also curious as to what was going on. In terms of people disappearing from care, that happens regularly, unfortunately. And often people are in care and they're not in their home county, or they could be away from siblings or other members of the family. I'm not talking in any specific case. And there's an awful lot of been made, a lot of scaremongering about children in the care of Tuusla, and people saying it's certain things that are going on. I'm not saying, you know, things not should not be investigated, but I would suggest a lot of those missing children from Tuusla care are actually probably runaways as well. So always read a little bit behind. Always read a little bit behind the headlines. Got married there, eat and drink there. It got the best staff and definitely the best music. Thanks from Mark McLean. What's that in relation to? Where were we talking about? Oh, the Silver Tassie. Yes, of course, Mark. We talked about the Silver Tassie yesterday, didn't we? 25 years in the making. Very good. Greg, the weekend, next weekend, what the heck is the sunburnt? Definitely affected you. I was just wondering, and it was a throwaway comment, and thanks for texting in. On a Monday, is this weekend the following weekend, or the weekend that passed, and is next weekend the Thursday, the Saturday, Sunday coming up, or the one after? It's a nothing. It was just a bit of a distraction and something that popped into my head from a conversation. So on a Monday, is next weekend the following Saturday and Sunday, or is that this weekend? Okay. Greg, it's time you stopped giving the impression that all Enoch Burke has to do is apologise to the court. He doesn't have to apologise to the court, by the way. I'll read the text in full. Greg, it's time you stopped giving the impression that all Enoch Burke has to do is apologise to the court when they made a wrong decision to say he had no right to express his own opinions. It is in the courts that he should apologise to him and compensate him for taking away his constitutional rights. I get what you're saying, but again, I'm not going to do this every day. He was in school, right? He was at school and at events Initially in school, he was asked to refer to a student who's no longer there as they, them. He didn't like that. He didn't want to do that because of his beliefs. And you know, many people might actually say, you know what, fair play to him. And there was an issue too, an allegation that he raised these concerns with the principal at the time, also gone at a public function and in public, and it was quite disruptive, and he was suspended at that point pending an investigation. Then he began to turn up at the school, and he would stand outside the school, and he stood inside the school. The school, for right or wrong, took him to court to try and stop him doing that. He refused. The court ordered that he stay away from that school whilst the disciplinary procedure was ongoing. He has issues with that as well. The court says you can't keep going back to that school. He says, I'm going back to that school. And he went back to that school and he was stood outside the school. And that was in breach of the court order. And the court then obviously had him arrested and put into jail. If he says that he will no longer attend that school, then he's free. Now, that doesn't talk to what the stuff that happened before that about his religious beliefs or his rights or his freedom of expression or whatever you want to call it. I don't know. There are competing rights here. They've got you've got his rights and you've got the child's rights, who's not there any longer, and you've got other students' rights. There's a lot of people have rights too. It's not just Mr. Berg. But as I say, I'm not in any way diminishing the whole case. I'm just simply pointing out, and it is a statement of absolute fact, that if he says he won't go near that school again, he walks out of jail. What happens after that, what cases he wants to take, what he wants to use his platform for is completely up to him, but that is what it comes down to. Greg, Friday and Saturday is this weekend. Saturday is the seventh day of the week, thus Saturday is the end of the week. Sunday's the first day of a new week. Is that any help, Mary? No, it's not, Mary. I don't know. I never understand why calendars start with Sunday. I always thought that was really quite confusing. Not all of them, but certainly some of them. All right, listen, thanks so much for all of your correspondence. Keep it coming into us, 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. Martin McHugh is going to join us very shortly. We're going to reflect on the impact in a sporting sense, but also beyond sport, of the late and great Micheál Ómarhurtig. That's coming up after we take a break. Now, as we learnt yesterday, legendary Gaelic Games commentator Micheál Ómarhurtig has died at the age of 93. His first assignment for RTÉ was to provide an all-Irish commentary on the 1949 Railway Cup final on St. Patrick's Day, and he continued teaching up until the mid-1980s when he became a full-time broadcaster with RTÉ. And I suppose his voice is the soundtrack for some fantastic memories, some heartbreak as well, but he certainly will always be associated with football, with Gaelic commentary. Martin McHugh joins us in studio. Thank you so much for joining us, Martin.
No problem, Greg.
There are levels in anything in life, isn't there? Even in this chair, like, I do my best here, but there are levels above and levels below, of course. And in commentary too, there are really good commentators, but there are levels above really good commentators. And in my view, for what it's worth, Micheál was just on a top level.
Yeah, just it's funny you say that. And I was thinking that coming in. Charles Burns is now looked on. Coming to Glasgow, always said to me that he was up here at the Irish College, and he says every house I go into up here, Highland Radio is on. So you're the voice of the Northwest, where his radio, how important radio is, where his voice was the voice of Ireland. You know, he was known in every house. I mean, there's households that turn down the television and put on the radio just to listen to his commentary. He was a great man, Greg. He was a great man with people, and he had time for everybody, and he was never in a rush, and he'd done everything. And I enjoyed it. I worked with him towards the end of his career with RTÉ and everything else, and he was great to work with.
What was that like?
He was unbelievable, because he had a wild passion for it. You know, you do get commentators that are doing it, it's a job and everything else, but he had a massive passion for it. Coming from West Kerry and everything else we came from, he was a person that everybody knew in the GAA, but he never kicked a ball actually ever himself. So that's, but he was great to work with, and just all off the cuff. And he had these great one-liners, you know, that he would come out with. And I was just thinking there today, if he was commentating, we're saying the Donegal game on Sunday, we say, you know, something like, you know, Shane O'Donnell has the ball, passes to Niall O'Donnell, back, brothers, back to Shane O'Donnell, still brothers, you know, that kind of simple thing. And then he just moved on from it. So, yeah, he was a... He was a brilliant. His voice was unbelievable. And he made a very, very poor game brilliant. Even the football now, people say about across the field and everything else, he would still make it exciting because he would start telling stories. He'd have more time now, actually, with the football now, Greg, to tell more
stories. But that takes a great level of skill because some people might find that annoying. So you have to do that right.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And if you want to use little phrases, and everyone has, and he's got some very, very famous lines, they have to be really well delivered and well thought out to land like they did with him, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. I suppose the big one you always think back on is the famous one where Pat Fox had the ball and the Galway player Rabbit was following him up the field and he says, I've all seen it all now. He says a rabbit following a fox in Croke Park and he just moves on from it. They're so simple but they're brilliant and you know, everything he done and he had a great life and he was very, very good to people and you know the big thing is. And I was just listening to John O'Mahony on RTÉ Radio this morning and he was actually crying about Tommy Gorman because he was just telling a story how close he was to Tommy Gorman and he said that Tommy was the first man doing video analysis and when Tommy Gorman trusted you, he really trusted you and he was a great man, Tommy Gorman. Tommy Gorman came down just to say Tommy Gorman, Greg, to our house in 1983 was a big thing when we were playing in All-Ireland semi-final and Tommy landed down with RTÉ and it was a big thing for RTÉ coming to your house that time but he was so good and so simple and so
two
kind.
But
he was doing video analysis for time but Béla Murthy took a presence into a room that not everybody has. He always carried a presence. Any room he was in, I noticed, when he came into even the canteen in Croke Park, he came in there, he just carried that presence. Everybody realised Micheál has arrived. And, you know, and every manager allowed him into dressing rooms. Now, people, and you give him the team, but you could trust him. And Darragh Caneja told a story, I was just listening to him on Reading the Gaeltacht, telling a story, Darragh Caneja, where he wanted to speak to Micheál before every game. He was comfortable then playing All-Ireland semi-finals and finals. But every manager trusted him to give him the team and he would tell nobody else and he kept them teams. It doesn't matter if Kerry was playing or not. He was very sincere like that.
But you talked about how, you know, an awful lot of people in commentary, not an awful lot, but certainly particularly in other sports, have a background in the sport or they've played the sport at a certain level or what have you. As you mentioned, Micheál, his sporting career certainly not up to his broadcasting career. So that makes it extra special to get the level of respect, not from fans necessarily, but particularly from people in the game.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
What I mean?
And the other thing is, he's gone from commentating for 14 years and still everybody's on about him now. And you think even younger people realise who he was. And I mean, listen, we're never going to see the likes of him again, ever in comedy, how good he was and everything. I mean, with changing times and everything else now and games on TV and everything else. But even in 1992, he said before the All-Ireland final, if Donegal won the All-Ireland, I'll come to Donegal.
Mm-hmm.
And he came down to Donegal and he was on the bus with us and all travelling around.
Really?
He sat on the bus with us and all travelling around. Yeah, he was a brilliant, it was great to have him, which everybody said was meant.
And what was his role in that? What was his role like? He just
came down and sat on the bus and travelled. He doesn't even drink or anything. He just travelled around with us to a couple of things. He's just that type of man. He said he was coming down and he's a man of his word and he came down, you know, and I really... Someone I would have to thank him for. He came down to my mother's funeral and all in Kilcare, him and the wife, and we've great photographs of him, you know, in Kilcare with the different people from the club and everything else. But he went to a lot of clubs and Comórtas Pell and the Gaeltacht that was important to him. The Irish language was very important to him and he was brilliant the way of commentary. He would just throw in these the Irish language and, you know, just and move on as well. So
it was so inclusive and so natural and so enjoyable. And I can't believe it's that long retired, actually. And just in relation to sort of working with him, were you doing co-coms with him?
Yeah, co-coms.
And how was that? Because there's a time for you to speak and a time for him to speak. And, you know, did you find that easy to work with him?
Yeah, no, he worked it well. You worked it well when the ball maybe went out wide or something else. He always let you in and everything else. But he had his own say. Now, he found it, of all the commentators, he was the one that found it the most difficult because he never had a co-com.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, but... I always had a great time and he had a great time for me, lucky enough, and we worked well together and everything else and I enjoyed working with him. But you want to see him, you know, the passion, him, I was up beside him, the passion he would have about a game and everything else and him turning around and he would turn around and he never looked at a TV screen or anything else.
Really? It was all done straight
up on the pitch and straight off the pitch and everything else and, you know, it was great looking. It's great looking back in it now to have actually worked with him, you know, with the greatest that we've ever had. Now, Milo Hare before him was very good as well. Neil O'Hare was a different kind of commentator to Emile Murthy, but it was a passion that he had for it. And I mean, hurling, he made Munster hurling. He really made it with his commentary on Munster hurling. There were people maybe never listened to hurling matches who would actually listen to it just to listen to Emile Murthy's commentating. And I mean, it was great. You made it in the GAA when you played a game that Emile Murthy commentated on. Yeah. Really, that's how important it was, you know. And he just did similar things. I remember us playing, I think it was a league game one day, and hearing back the comedy afterwards, and he was on about Tony Boyle had the ball, and he says his dad is listening to us in the bog. You know, he just had simple lines like that.
Where did he get that that side information? I think that was brilliant. I don't know.
He was brilliant at it.
Must have been research. Yeah, must have had them banked for an appropriate moment.
Yeah,
to bring them
and I always got him. People, I think a lot of people, Conley, I remember he used to have pages with them of people looking for all over the world, looking for him to mention their name or play a request for them or something.
So he would glance down, and that would be.
And he always got through it, and he got through it nice and easy and simple and everything else. But he knew, I think he knew somebody in every village and townland and town in the country, because he seemed to know people everywhere he went and everything else. And he was big into poetry and all that there. And
he had the voice, the hurler's poem and what have you, just in such this amazing delivery, such a lovely accent, a rich, soft but powerful voice at the same time.
I think
time.
A lot of, you know, he did poetry maybe at graveyards and everything else, at funerals and everything else, and the reckoning was unreal.
Yeah, and I suppose it is a sign of changing times, and I don't know if this is a generational thing, but if you look across sports, football commentators, boxing commentators, soccer commentators, horse racing commentators that are elevated to stardom, you know, through that, you just don't see that anymore. Maybe it is the co-commentator and the panels that have come in, but you know, I can think of all the sports I mentioned, motor racing, you know what I mean? You can go to, and you can sort of say of a very, very famous standout person. Now we've got fantastic commentators, not least here in Highland, but it's just whatever has evolved, I don't see a celebrity coming out of commentary.
I would totally agree.
Where I'm coming from.
I think you're right. I think it's the co-coms coming in and different things out there, because you had Murray Walker in the thing. Yeah. Murray, and then
Ian Dart with boxing.
You have famous Peter O'Sullivan, who was unbelievable commentator in horse racing. And you definitely, it is a different, it's different now, because you do have more people maybe doing it and everything else, but that's why they'll go down. You know, you still
golf,
go back. Bill McLaren was unreal, and rugby as well. You back and listen to his commentary. But I think you said it, the voice. They had the voice for it. The voice carried it, for the voice for radio. The voice
I think a lot of it actually comes as well too, that a lot of the people we're talking about, maybe they started the commentary on radio or primarily on radio, and they get more descriptive and the voice is more important, and then they sort of we recognise them and get to know them on the television. Yeah. Maybe that's part of it, but now everything is
I think you're right,
everything's so accessible
now. Just tell you a couple of stories, really small quick stories about him. One was he never really said who was the greatest footballer he ever seen, but I did ask him myself one day, just because I was loving asking people about who was the greatest footballer, and I asked him and he said Jack O'Shea.
Right.
He said to me, and I asked Mick O'Dwyer the exact same question, and Mick O'Dwyer said Jack O'Shea as well. So I think, and Darragh Kinnear just said the blue-eyed boy with Michael Murthy was Jack O'Shea today. I listened to him on the radio today. But another brilliant story about him. In 2014, there was a charity event to climb Cairn Tuath. Michael Murthy would be 84 on the 20th of August, which is just now. You basically see he's 84 now. That was in 2014, and he climbed Cairn Tuath as an 84-year-old man. And we all waited at the top, and he climbed it, and he got no help, and he climbed the whole way up, and we gave him a standing ovation at the top. There were a lot of GA people, a lot of different people. He'd done it that, and that's 10 years ago now, and he climbed it. I'll never forget it. I was up at the top, and it was a great occasion just when he landed up at the top, and he climbed the whole lot, and it's not an easy mountain for a young person to climb, and he climbed it.
Such was his, I was going to say stubbornness, but it's determination, obviously, to be able to do that. Amazing stuff. And do you know what? Like, he had a long life. It's very sad anyone passing. But, you know, what a legacy to leave. If we could all do that. I mean, you're halfway there, Martin. I'm not. But do you know what I mean? Like, that has to. He's got so much to celebrate as well. Obviously, his passing is very sad, but he's written into the history books.
You're right. He had a long life. And I just now mentioned an uncle of mine, Uncle Pat Daniels Cunningham, who's actually 92 today.
Good man. Happy
living
birthday,
on his own
Pat.
In great form and everything else. And, you know, I'd finish it off by saying, you know, as Gilligan, they vein lead a re-shun. Can't you? And that's really it. I mean, there'll never be the likes of him again in the GAA. And it's a massive miss. But it's great, you know, the whole send-off he's getting and with people, you know, the loving for the family that's out there and everything else.
And also, too, he was very celebrated in life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's another side of it. Often we wait till someone's passed before they... But I think he knew how important he was to the public.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, said, you know, there's people everywhere he went, you know, and it's very hard to get them people, as I said, to either walk into a room and carry that aura that he just carried into that room. I remember Charlie Howe carried it. I remember seeing for a smaller man, different people, you know yourself what I'm saying, different people, but he always carried it. Yeah, great man.
All right, he'd be looking forward to the weekend for quarterfinals. Are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, I don't really ever look forward, as I will tell you, when Donegal's playing.
I do wonder sometimes why you go to games.
I don't know why you go to games is right, but I'll always remember. And, I'm looking forward to it. It's great, and, you know, it's great to be there, you know, the quarter final. And if we could get to a semi final, I think we haven't been there since 14. So Louth are going to be very tough. They're going to take a big crowd and take everything else. And, you know, they can sleep in their own bed, which has always been classed as a simple thing, where Donegal have to travel up the night before, no hotel. But really looking forward to it. And it's great. It's great for the whole county. It's given the whole county a buzz and a lift and everything else. And
such a turnaround,
you know, and it'll
such
be an emotional time too, with Kerry playing afterwards with Míle Murthy and all the whole thing with Míle Murthy and everything else. So it's great times for Donegal, and please God we'll get over the line. That's the big important thing. But, you know, always dangerous when you're playing against a team that everybody expects you to beat.
100%. Yeah. And we've seen a lot of that in this championship. And just finally, how do you see the Derry Kerry game going?
That's a big game, because just to let people know about the draw quickly, you know, if Dublin and Kerry won and Donegal and Armagh won, Donegal can't play Armagh again. So, as you said yourself the last day on the radio, so Donegal and Armagh going to one hat in Dublin and Kerry. But if there's a shock anywhere, we'll just say Derry beat Kerry, if we'll keep it simple of that there, or Roscommon won or Louth won, it's different. But if Derry just happened to beat Kerry, you'd have three Ulster teams and they all have played each other. Mm-hmm. So it would be an open draw then if that happened with Dublin, if Derry beat Kerry. So we'll never know to the weekend how it's going to go, how the thing's going to go, but it'd be great if you get into that hat. But yeah, I think Derry have a chance, a great chance. Because Kerry haven't played a Division 1 team this year. So they're coming in very, very cold. And somebody said to me, a great stat, Craig, Mickey Hart has as good a record against Jack O'Connor and Kerry as Jim McGuinness has against Mickey Hart. So that's a great record. So Hart will have no fear and Kerry will be afraid of them. So I think it's a big game, really, that we're looking forward to.
Yeah, indeed. What a doubleheader. I think a lot of people will be staying on for the second game, no doubt. Martin, thank you very much. And thanks for coming in and helping us remember and celebrate the life and achievements and the impact of...
Thanks, Greg. I really appreciate being asked and
to
say it about him.
All right, take care. All right, I think most of us watch an awful lot of crime TV. A lot of it is the forensic side of stuff. But would you not like an insight into the realities of it, the real work of a forensic expert, one that worked within Gardaí, with Gardaí, and worked on some... you know, really big cases? Well, you can, because there's a new book out. It's called Identity, Murder, Fraud and the Making of a Garda Forensic Expert. And that person is John Sweetman, also the author of the book. Good morning to you, John. Thank you very much for your time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you on board. How long have you been working on the book, John?
Well, I retired from the Guards in September, the end of September last year. So it was really shortly after that I started to put pen to paper, and, you know, just it took about 2 or 3 months. It came together quite easily.
All right, that probably is your forensic background coming to the fore and helping you out there, I wonder.
Well, it's probably my, I don't know, my tenacity to have things detailed. Like, I had it broadly worked out in my head what it was going to be, like, you know.
When did you join the Guards? And at that point, did you have any interest in the forensic side of things, John?
No, I had no interest in or even awareness of the forensic field. And I had no connections to the Guards. There was nobody else in the family had been in the force. But primarily what I wanted to do after I left school was to pursue art. Mm. And I got into an animation company in Dublin, Murakami Wolf, that at the time were producing the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoons. And, you know, I was very happy there for a few years until, you know, they lost the contract and had to let a lot of us go. And that just kind of coincided with the Guards putting out a recruitment drive. And, you know, I applied for it, not really giving much thought to, you know, what it meant. But before I knew it, I was in Templemore starting training, you know.
Yeah, but it was not rosy for you in your early career as a guard, John.
No, as I say, before I really, you know, had time to think about what I was taking on, I was in the Templemore Training College. I was back in a uniform, something I swore I'd never do again. I mentioned it in the book. As soon as I left school, I took great pride in taking off the school uniform and swore I'd never wear one again or be in a regimented kind of system. And here I was in the Guards. And, you know, not too long after I completed my training and came out from Templemore, you know, it dawned on me that maybe this wasn't the career move for me. You know, it's not a job for everybody. And I was lacking a lot of self-confidence, and which is something you really do need to have in a guard's position. And, you know, for the first few years, I was quite unhappy and considered quitting it, until I, you know, almost by accident came across the Garda Technical Bureau.
Yeah, and talk to us about that. And of course, we're not going to spoil the book because people will want to follow this story in the book, John, but it was a happenstance, really, was it?
Yeah, like there'd been an assault in a pub in the locality where I was stationed, and a publican had been glassed, and I accompanied one of my colleagues into the Garda Technical Bureau with the pint glass that had been used for the purposes of having it fingerprinted. And it really opened my eyes to, you know, these other avenues within the Guards that I hadn't been aware of, like the fingerprint department and you know, the other sections of the Garda Technical Bureau, ballistics and mapping, photography. It really appealed to me. And I think it appealed to my kind of, you know, probably the artistic traits and my attention to detail and, you know, stuff like that. So I really zoomed in on wanting to get into the Bureau at that stage and was lucky enough to get into the fingerprint section.
And either you spotted it in yourself or it was spotted in you. You had a natural ability, didn't you? You had a natural eye, a natural sense to see things perhaps others might not.
Yeah, like it's kind of funny because, as I said, I was severely lacking in confidence when it came to day-to-day policing and maybe interactions with people and stuff like that. But what I very quickly found in my role as a fingerprint expert and then later on as a document and handwriting expert was that I was very confident in my ability. And, identifying fingerprints, for instance, is, you know, it's a very exacting and detail-orientated discipline. And you really have to be, confident in processing the details that you're looking at and then coming to a qualified opinion as to whether or not it's an identification. And it seemed to come quite easy to me. And I never had doubts about my findings, you know.
Well, I was going to ask you that because obviously we're talking now at a time where fingerprints were being manually tested. And I'm sure sometimes those that were recovered for a crime scene weren't always perfect or might be smudged or whatever. In your own mind, when you gave an affirmative, a match, what was your percentage of certainty in your own mind?
Well, that's a question you're always asked, and it comes to court in any kind of identification evidence. What percentage are you, or what number out of 10? And I'd never answer that question because every single crime scene mark or finger mark from a crime is different. Every piece of handwriting is different. There's so many variables involved. But what happens is, say, if you have a very clear fingerprint, then you have a low threshold for discrepancy, if you know what I mean. If all the detail is there, and everything is in agreement and whatnot, you have a lower threshold for allowing for any, you know, differences. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you've got a crime scene mark that's, you know, only a partial mark or made in blood or there's kind of a movement in it or something like that, then you have a higher threshold for discrepancy. So you can't really break things down into percentages. Yeah. You know, it's not like when you're testing for DNA or drugs or something where you get, you know, an analysis printout or something like that gives you, you know, the amount out of a million or whatever it may be. No, with the fields that I worked in, it was much more reliant on the expert opinion of the examiner.
Of course.
And any identifications or anything that were made were always then verified independently by at least two other experts.
And of course, they form part of a suite of evidence for the most part, that it's linking a number of different things together. I'm just curious also, you talked about your school experience, which kind of resonates with me a little bit, then your initial Garda experience, and then obviously going into the area that you did. You went on then to spend 25 years as a detective Garda. Did you ever, you then did begin to feel... You fit into the guards, did you, or did you always feel a sort of around in the square hole?
I felt that I fit more into the organisation as a whole, but I never really considered myself a guard, you know. And you know, I think I mentioned it in the book. One of the nicest compliments that I was ever given was by a fellow mule, as we referred to each other in the guards. When he met me in court, and me with my tattoos and beard and whatnot, he said to me, "You're the most un-mule-like whatever that I've ever come across." And I thought, geez, that's great, like, you know. But, you know, whilst I didn't feel like a guard, I did feel that I was contributing to, you know, the Gardaí out there investigating crime. So, you know, that was very important to me.
So the story is told, obviously, we'll learn about you you know, how you became who you became from your beginnings and the experience we've talked of, but in much more detail. But also, too, that's interesting in and of itself. But also, too, if anyone's got an interest in genuinely how, in real terms, that we get to a resolution in terms of convicting someone for a crime or not, for that matter. The story you recount a number of your cases in the book as well, which I think will be of particular interest. Crime's huge, you know that yourself, obviously, yeah. John.
Yeah, like as I say, like as you mentioned, like what I would have been involved with were only small parts of large Garda investigations. You know, of course, serious things, murders, drugs, that type of stuff, but. Even stuff on a lower tier, like, you know, like check fraud and social welfare fraud, like they were big investigations, like investigating Gardaí, collating huge amounts of information and evidence. And say with check fraud cases, I could have had any number of, you know, could have had a couple of hundred checks with question signatures to be examined. And, you know, probably 9 times out of 10, when you get to court with these cases, which could very well be 2 or 3 years down the line, I'd be there ready to go with all my evidence, and the, you know, the defendant or the accused person would take a plea, or my evidence would be accepted, which can very often happen when you're given expert testimony, because if you've done your job right, the only person that can kind of refute that or cast a doubt on it is another expert.
Yeah.
And conversely, if they're doing their job right, they should come to the same conclusions. So, you know, it was quite often that I would travel the length and breadth of the country to give evidence and then not be required and just turn around and go back home. But, you know, also you could end up in a district court with what you thought might be a very simple, straightforward case and end up in the witness box for a long time, you know, so you just never knew.
And was that a source of frustration throughout your career, or did you realise that's part of parcel of it?
No, it could be, like, depending on the case, it could be very frustrating at times, but, you know, I quickly learned not to take it personally.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as long as if, you know, I turned up and if I gave my evidence, if it was accepted or not by the judge or the jury, that's okay. You know, as long as I was confident that I presented it correctly. Of course, you feel disappointed when things fall on technicalities, and you know the court system is just an absolute, you know, it's unbelievable to navigate, you know, with legal arguments and all these type of things. But and as I said, very often, like, the court thing could take place 2 or 3 years after your examination, mm-hmm. so you, by that stage, you would have moved on to many other cases.
Yeah, for sure. You talked about travelling the length and breadth of the country. Obviously, at times you were brought to Donegal.
Yes, I spent many a day up in Letterkenny Courthouse there with various cases, several handwriting cases in actual fact, you know, disputed signatures, usually to do with property or money and stuff like that. But then, of course, I had a small role to play in the murder of a girl, Jasmine McGonagall, in Donegal back in 2019, I think it was. And with that case, although they had plenty of evidence and they had the suspect and all of that, the investigating Gardaí wanted to build up a picture that Jasmine had been in fear of him mm-hmm. prior to the attack. And so they found some letters that she'd written to her partner, a fellow by the name of Richard Burke. And, you know, in this letter, she detailed that she was in fear of him and this, so they wanted to prove that to the court, that this was her state of mind and this was the situation that she was living in with her young kids. And, you know, although there was no doubt that she had written the letter, for that letter to be presented as evidence in court, it still had to be proven.
Yes.
And by that, I mean, like, you know, compared with specimen writings, other writings that Jasmine had made. And, you know, as a handwriting examiner, you don't really concern yourself too much with the content of what you're looking at, because you're looking at the constructions of the writing and all the little idiosyncrasies in a person's writing. But you can't help but soak in the content as well. And, you know, it was quite poignant, that letter that Jasmine had written, because she was very strong in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, maintaining that she had had enough and that she wasn't going to put up with it anymore. Mm. And, you know, I'd be sitting there at my desk with this piece of paper that had been penned by this poor, unfortunate girl not long before she was murdered. So, you know, it kind of hits home a little bit, even though I didn't attend the scene and, you know, what was, you know, I wasn't exposed to the gruesomeness of that. I still had a kind of, you know, window into yeah. her life,
yeah.
which to me, it's a big responsibility then as well to make sure that, you know, you do your job for her and for her family.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, the book is Identity, a fascinating read. Dr. Marie Cassidy, a great author in her own right, wrote Murder, Fraud and the Making of a God, a Forensic Expert, John Sweeney. John, obviously you have a flair for writing. This is about your experience. I can only presume this is not your last book.
I would hope not. Like,
so do you want to go into, I mean, given what you know and everything,
yeah.
Do you want to go into the sort of fiction side of things?
I would like to do that. I have a few ideas knocking around, but again, my attention to detail is sometimes hobbles me, because if I start writing something, then I'd say, no, that's not the way it would really happen. But then, yeah. you know, real life can sometimes not suit fiction. You have to kind of, you know, dress it a certain way. But no, that's certainly something that I would hope to get into. Yeah.
Brilliant. I'm sure you'll be really successful in that. John, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Fascinating insight. Well,
thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's author John Sweetman. It's a no-holes-barred memoir of an expert forensic investigator and the crimes he helped solve. Fascinating, darkly humorous, deeply courageous, Dr. Marie Cassidy wrote. It's available from all the usual places. If you're interested in that, the real side of it, you know, and sometimes the reality is stranger than fiction as well. We appreciate John's time this morning. I'll just get to some of your comments between now and then. A tape recording of Micheál's legendary commentary on Donegal's breakthrough year was a great journey shortener after the 92 final. We heard of the history of the four masters in between Martin Begg, as he christened him, kicking his third point over his shoulder, and of the fight of the Earls before Manus, the master, on the day, not profession, kicked his ninth and clinching point for Dunanall. Great memories. Thank you for sharing them with us. One of Micheál O'Mahertic's quotes, Seanóg O'Halpin, his father from Fermanagh, his mother's from Fiji, neither a hurling stronghold. He was simply the sound of a summer. Handy if you're out farming or in the bog on a clear day, you could hear his voice travel over miles, especially for the diaspora too. Thanks, Kevin in Dunlow. Appreciate that. Hi, Greg and Martin. Martin, listening to your stories about Micheál O'Mahertic, he was amazing. May he rest in peace. Tell Martin he's a brilliant commentator too. Love listening to him. Keep up the good work. Up Donegal, indeed, and up Donegal for the weekend as well. Greg, will you please read out that there's a lovely big orange cat lying on the side of the road just as you drive into Newtown Cunningham. Someone may be missing it or looking for it. It's unfortunately passed away. Okay, listen, that's not going to be good news for anyone to hear, but perhaps there is a search ongoing for a orange cat. Unfortunately, it seems to have succumbed on the side of Newtown Cunningham, on the side of the road driving into Newtown Cunningham. So Michael McGrath didn't take the job because of the €450,000 wage. Fair play to him. Now, will he donate half of it to a worthwhile charity? I doubt it somehow. I think it's over 300. Is it 450? I didn't think it was quite that much. Hi, Greg. Hear exactly what you're saying. I believe the public are now losing trust in pillars which are supposed to be impartial. Take a look at the Defence Forces. Natasha O'Brien case plants the seed in the public's mind. That's the scale of justice having a huge swing. I think that was me referencing the fact that I wouldn't be 100% confident with sort of collective responsibility, unless obviously there are indications that this is endemic or a major significant problem. Back in the 70s, when I frequented the district court, I often observed members of the Defence Forces up on criminal charges. In every case, if they were convicted, a commanding officer informed the judge that if they were fined more than £20, they would be dismissed from the army. The judge then fined them 19. So having convicted criminals continue to serve in the Defence Forces is acceptable? Asks that listener. Was that the exception or the rule? I don't know. Okay, we'll be back with the news in a sec.